Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Well, thank you. It is an honor to be here and to see some old friends and to meet some new ones. And I'm also excited to speak to you on this subject of St. Augustine and self-knowledge, because I do most of my work on St. Augustine. And one thing that has occurred to me is that Augustine had something approaching an obsession with self-knowledge, and that this lasted the whole of his life. And you can just see it in his writings come up again and again. In a very early writing, he has this imaginary conversation with his reason as like sort of two characters in a play. And reason asks him, "What do you want to know?" And Augustine replies, "God and the soul." And reason says, "Anything else?" And Augustine says, "Nothing whatsoever." He's most insistent. And so reason says, "All right, well, sum up your desires in a prayer." And Augustine replies, "O God, may I know you, may I know myself." Right? And that kind of is, in a nutshell, Augustine's lifelong quest. One can certainly understand this preoccupation. The injunction to know thyself is at least as old as the oracle at Delphi, and it essentially became the cornerstone of classical philosophy. Think of Socrates' famous aphorism, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Despite their differences, the one thing that all the myriad schools of classical philosophy had in common was a desire to achieve or at least approximate self-knowledge. But self-knowledge was not just for the philosopher. It was also a priority of the early and medieval church. In the 1970s, a French scholar by the name of Pierre Courcelle collected all the references he could find to knowing oneself, starting with Plato and ending with Bernard of Clairvaux. He filled two massive volumes, but even then could have kept going. And I trust that this quest for self-knowledge or this interest in self-knowledge is relevant to us as members of a university community. For it seems to me that one of the differences between training and education is that training helps you master a particular set of skills, while education, especially higher education, helps you see and understand the world better. And that understanding, I would hope, includes a better understanding of oneself. I'm tempted to say to you students that if you spent 4 years and graduate without gaining any self-knowledge whatsoever, you might be entitled to a full refund. However, I'm also poignantly aware of the fact that it could also be your fault for not paying attention. So I don't know where we land on that. In any event, let us turn to St. Augustine and see how he can help us with the quest to know oneself. The first thing to recognize is that Augustine does not think there is only one kind of self-knowledge, but three: intellectual self-knowledge, moral self-knowledge, and religious self-knowledge. These three forms, incidentally, are dramatized in books 7, 8, and 9 of the Confessions. But they're also in many other places in his writings. Each of these kinds of self-knowledge, in Augustine's terminology, is achieved by having a certain kind of conversion or turning. So an intellectual turning, a moral turning, a religious turning gives you this self-knowledge. So let's just look at each of these three in turn. And then at the end of each one, I'm also going to mention the obstacles that stand in the way of achieving these kinds of self-knowledge. And then finally, at the very end, I'm going to end with two sort of general questions in the hopes of generating some discussion. So the first kind of self-knowledge is intellectual self-knowledge. And I don't know if this one is the hardest to attain. It may be. For me, at least, it is certainly the hardest to explain. For philosophers like Plato, the key breakthrough in philosophy is to recognize the difference between the sensible and the intelligible. That is to say, to recognize that there is a difference according to the reality of space, time, and matter, and a reality that lies beyond space, time, and matter. A reality that is not empirical, but nevertheless real. As a matter of fact, arguably for Plato, that world is more real than the world that we can touch, taste, see, hear, etc. So this insight into intelligible reality is absolutely crucial to philosophizing, at least in the ancient sense. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult to conceive of reality that is not temporal or spatial or material. And for Augustine, this problem was crystallized in the fact that he really, really was starting to believe in the Christian God. He knew that Christianity taught that God was spirit and not body, which is talking about God qua God, not the incarnation, right? So I know that God is real. I know he's spirit and not body. But every time I think of God, I think of him in some sort of bodily way. But I know that's not true. But if it's not true, what is true? How do I think about this? To give you one example, Augustine pictured the universe as a sponge and God as water that filled every nook and cranny of the sponge, but was different from the sponge. The problem with this analogy is that it leads to absurdities. For if it is true, there is more God in an elephant than in a sparrow. There is more God in a fat man than in a thin man. Now, when you put on your freshman 15, you say, got more God, right? Doesn't quite work that way, does it? Alas. But what alternative is there to understanding God materially? For Augustine, the key to understanding the difference between the sensible and the intelligible is to know something about yourself, specifically your mind. For your mind is an intelligible reality and not a sensible one. Let me unpack that, but first, let me read you this passage from the Confessions. Thus was I so gross of mind, not seeing even myself clearly, that whatever was not extended in space, I thought must be nothing whatsoever. Okay, think about that. I kept thinking to myself, if it's not spatial, if I can't locate it on a Cartesian grid, it can't be real. If I can't picture it, how can it be real? Right? And to picture it, I got to picture it spatially. My mind was in search of such images as the forms my eye was accustomed to see, and I did not realize that the mental act by which I formed these images was not itself a bodily image. Yet it could not have formed them unless it were something, and something great. That which forms images in you is literally unimaginable. The power of imagination is unimaginable, and yet it's real. So there is your example of an intelligible reality. Know your mind, and you know that your mind is spirit and not body. In other words, your mind is not your brain. Your brain, of course, is very important. And if your brain were to get damaged, it would affect the operations of your mind. But just because of this tight union between mind and brain, it doesn't mean that they're synonymous. The brain is a sensible reality. The mind is an intelligible reality, an intelligible and intelligent reality. And so if you can understand the mind, you understand an intelligible reality. And if you understand an intelligible reality, this gives you a foothold into understanding how God is spirit. So this is how Augustine describes it in the Confessions. Being admonished by all this to return to myself, I entered into my own depths with you as guide. And I would be speaking to God, and I was able to do it because you were my helper. I entered, and with the eye of my soul, such as it was, I saw your unchangeable light shining over that same eye of my soul, over my mind. It was not the light of every day that the eye of flesh can see, nor some greater light of the same order. Your light was not that, but other, altogether other than all such lights. Nor was it above my mind as oil above the water it floats on. It was above because it made me. And I was below because I was made by it. He who knows the truth knows that light. And he that knows the light knows eternity. That's a very strong statement. And notice this is not a religious mystical experience. This is a philosophical turn to the self, which recognizes the intelligible character of the soul. By intellectual self-knowledge, then, we do not mean falling in love with the life of the mind or becoming a bibliophile of the best that has been thought and written, as excellent as these things are. What we mean is the discovery of one's mind as an intelligible reality that is participating in the supreme intelligibility we call God. There are two obstacles to an intellectual conversion, two things preventing intellectual self-knowledge. The first is our daily habits, which privilege the sensible world. There is absolutely nothing wrong with being an embodied soul that receives data from the senses. That is to say, there's nothing wrong with being a human person. Some of my best friends are human persons. But because our intellects develop slowly over time, our fixation with the senses gets a head start. Moreover, even as students or teachers who would rather contemplate the Platonic forms all day, isn't it true that we spend most of our mental energies during our waking hours thinking about the things within the world of space, time, and matter? Where do I have to be? When do I have to do it? What's going on? What's for dinner, right? These are all, most of our mental energies are spent dealing with these kinds of empirical matters. And the problem is, if you spend 90% of your day thinking about those empirical matters, your ability to think about the non-empirical could atrophy, right? So it's not that the senses are bad. It's just that we can get into a habit of privileging the sensible and losing a sense of what our minds are also capable of knowing. The second obstacle is sin, which mires us even further in this passing world. In the Confessions, Augustine writes that he was not able to savor his intellectual breakthrough for very long because he was, quote, soon torn away by his own weight and fell again with torment to lower things. Intellectual acumen and judgment are different from moral integrity, but they are still connected. My sins do have a negative impact on my ability to think clearly, dispassionately, and maturely. So those are the two obstacles to intellectual self-knowledge. Let's turn to moral self-knowledge. In addition to an intellectual conversion, there needs to be a moral conversion. What is the point of being wise, Augustine says of himself, when I remain the vile slave of evil desires? Besides a conversion of one's intellect or understanding, there needs to occur a conversion of one's behavior or mores. And as with an intellectual breakthrough, a moral breakthrough can yield moral self-knowledge. Moral self-knowledge consists of knowing oneself as a sinner clearly and decisively without any excuses or evasions. And it is important because it begins the process of repentance and healing. For the first step to any cure is a proper diagnosis. The obstacles to moral self-knowledge are fairly clear. First, we don't want to know ourselves as a sinner because the truth is too ugly. As Augustine writes, men love the truth when it enlightens them. They hate the truth when it accuses them. Because they do not wish to be deceived and do wish to deceive, they love the truth when it reveals itself. They hate the truth when it reveals them. A cartoon I once saw illustrates the point nicely. A husband turns to his wife and says, I think I just had an epiphany. How do I make it go away? Aesop tells the story that when Jupiter made man, he gave him two knapsacks, one for his neighbor's faults and one for his own. The man kept the one for his neighbor's faults in front of him and the one for his own on his back. In the Confessions, when Augustine finally recounts seeing his moral failings for what they were, he uses a similar image of hiding himself from himself. You, O God, turned me back towards myself, taking me from behind my own back where I put myself all the time that I preferred not to see myself, and you set me there before my own face that I might see how vile I was, how twisted and unclean and spotted and ulcerous. I saw myself and was horrified. It takes a small miracle to see oneself as one truly is, in no small part because the miracle is so resisted. A moral conversion can be prompted in different ways. In Augustine's life, it was a combination of interpreting an everyday event as a sign from heaven. The sound of a neighborhood kid singing, take and read, as well as hearing stories of people just like him who were able to leave their sin behind. After hearing their testimonies, Augustine writes, there was no way to flee from myself. If I tried to turn my gaze from myself, there was Ponticianus telling what he was telling. And again, you were setting me face to face with myself, forcing me upon my own sight that I might see my iniquity and loathe it. In that crucial moment, Augustine was able to overcome all the clever dodges, rationalizations, justifications, and excuses, and to see himself as he truly was. And thanks to that, moments later, he was healed. The reluctance to see the truth about ourselves is particularly difficult because it is fueled by a desire to be seen a certain way by the people around us. This is the second obstacle to moral self-knowledge. So the first one was we don't want to see the truth about ourselves. And the second one is we sure as hell don't want other people to see the truth about ourselves. We spend our lives hiding our own dark and disordered hearts from our neighbors. And so much so that we start hiding it from our very selves. Reason declares there is no better way of seeking the truth than by questioning and answering. And yet hardly anyone can be found who isn't ashamed of being refuted in a disputation. As a result, it's almost always the case that something that comes off, that's off to a good start is booed off the stage by the rowdiness of stubbornness. So in other words, we learn from each other through Q&A, but then because Q&A involves putting our reputation on the line, we get testy. And then the disputation, which is supposed to be about the truth, becomes something about protecting our egos. And then the quest for the truth gets derailed. And I'll mention one other obstacle besides sin, besides our desire to be seen a certain way, is a sinful habit. As Augustine explains in the Confessions, we can abuse our free will in such a way that we effectively lose it. Because my will was perverse, he writes, it changed to lust, and lust yielded to become habit, and habit not resisted became necessity. That is as tidy a summary of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics as one can find, even though Augustine never read the Ethics. Similarly, he writes that moments before his moral conversion, he still shrank from dying unto death and living unto life. The lower condition, which had grown habitual, was more powerful than the better condition, which he had not yet tried. We know our life is hell, but at least it's a hell we know. And we're afraid of making that leap to something better, which we don't know. So that can be a problem. The third kind of self-knowledge is religious self-knowledge. Moral conversion begins the life of ethical excellence. It even makes one fit to have the best kinds of friendship. That said, neither intellectual nor moral self-knowledge satisfies the deepest yearnings of the human heart. Something more is needed, both as a completion and a grounding of these other conversions, and in order to bring the person to full happiness. Hence the need for religious conversion, which in biblical terms is simply the replacement of one's heart of stone with a heart of flesh. This heart of flesh enables one to love the Lord God with one's whole heart, whole soul, and whole strength. Religious conversion is a surrender to divine love. It is religious in its modern meaning, as ordered towards a formal and communal worship of God, but it is also religious in its ancient meaning. A religio is a binding. And so when you get religion, you find yourself bound to God. For Augustine, both senses are operative. And both happened to him when he received the sacrament of baptism. The sacrament of baptism was both an initiation into the formal worship and structure of the Catholic Church, but it was also a binding to God. His baptismal vows bound him to God and vice versa. And then once you have this religious conversion, in addition to knowing the good and doing the good, your heart is now fully capable of loving the good. For Augustine, the claim, I'm spiritual but not religious, which one often hears these days, makes no sense whatsoever. To be spiritual is to be bound to the truth, and the truth has corporate consequences, both for you and for me. Religious self-knowledge, then, is the knowledge of oneself as a creature and as a beloved child of God. It makes moral self-knowledge bearable, for with religious self-knowledge comes trust in the help of the Lord and the possibility of forgiveness. It also completes intellectual self-knowledge, which kind of tops out at the recognition that my knowing is somehow tied into God. Finally, religious self-knowledge is crucial because self-knowledge and the knowledge of God go hand in hand. Augustine's twin obsession with God, with knowing God in the soul, is inextricably intertwined. The obstacles standing in the way of religious conversion are obviously any of the things that undermine or prevent religious faith. Augustine identifies two opposite vices that are particularly deadly, even though they are opposite, they have the same effect: despair and presumption. Despair that you will ever find the truth effectively discourages you from embarking on a quest for the truth. And so does presumption. the false opinion that you have already discovered the truth. If you don't think the truth can be discovered, or if you think you've already discovered the truth and you haven't, interestingly enough, the effect is the same. You will stop seeking the truth. So, two final questions to generate some self-discussion. Having surveyed these three kinds of self-knowledge in Augustine's thought and their obstacles, I would like us to think about our contemporary situation. Rub these two sticks together. First, how responsible is the modern American university for encouraging all three forms of self-knowledge? I don't have an answer to this, but I think it's an interesting question, even for a non-religious university to ask this question. And it may depend on a lot of different circumstances. For example, in his idea of a university, St. John Henry Newman thinks of the university as the primary locus for intellectual formation. But he was thinking of the Oxford model, which has a university and then some 39 colleges, where Newman thinks that is where moral formation should take place. So that's interesting, right? When we don't have the Oxford model, what do we do? Do we have a different division of labor? Whose responsibility is it? So that's my first question. My second question is, what is the relationship between the Augustinian kinds of self-knowledge and more modern forms of self-knowledge? On one hand, the last century has seen a growing emphasis placed on certain concepts, such as consciousness raising or raising awareness about certain aspects of our existence, particularly our participation in a system or society that is unjust. The most recent iteration of this sensibility is the so-called woke movement, but the framework itself can be traced back to Hegel's theory of the master-slave dialectic. The idea is simple. A slave who gains a certain consciousness of his servitude is liberated from the shackles of his master. He sees through the delusion, recognizes that he's been victimized, and in that recognition of his victimhood, the master no longer reigns over him. The master can no longer delude him. He is free. This idea is neatly summarized in perhaps an unusual place, the movie Barbie. In the movie, Gloria, played by the wonderful actress America Ferrera, gives a speech on the near impossibility of being a woman. Her words have the effect of breaking Pulitzer Barbie from a trance induced by the patriarchal poison that Ken had brought back with him from Century City. Hope I'm not giving away any plot spoilers. After Pulitzer Barbie returns to her senses, stereotypical Barbie exclaims with glee to Gloria, "By giving voice to the cognitive dissonance required to be a woman under the patriarchy, you robbed it of its power." Who would have thought that the clearest articulation of the philosophy of Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel would come from a silicon doll with permanently arched feet and no cellulite? But my question about the Hegelian master-slave dialectic, which is operative in popular ideologies like Marxism and feminism, is this. Is the dialectic an updated version of the quest for Augustinian self-knowledge, or is it a substitute for it, a rejection of it? Are consciousness raising and awareness raising and being woke developments of the age-old quest to know thyself, or are they a sign that we have given up on the Socratic and Augustinian examined life? It is beyond the scope of my presentation to answer that question, but I will conclude with one consideration. Much of the kind of thought that I have been describing is predicated on a victimology that involves a strict binary between the victim and the victimizer, in which it is possible to be only one or the other. And if you're not a victim, the next best thing is to empathize radically with the victim in order to avoid the stigma of being an oppressor. One problem with this binary is that it could discourage self-knowledge by presupposing or assuming that victims cannot be oppressors. But I submit to you that that is not true. Victims can victimize other people. Victims can be oppressors. Several years ago, the Wall Street Journal reported a growing problem in the Republic of Ireland, which only recently has had to deal with a significant minority population within its borders. Whereas I'm sure you know, Ireland, for most of her history, God bless her, has been good at exporting people. But only recently has she been importing people. There are many Middle Eastern and Nigerian immigrants currently in Ireland, and they're often the subject of ignorant microaggressions. Felicia Olusanya, 24, a poet and author who came to Ireland from Nigeria at the age of 8, has experienced racism, including slurs, hostile looks, and monkey noises. And yet she does not attribute this behavior of the Irish to a racist or white supremacist ideology, but to a fixation on their past mistreatment by the British. Quote, there's a lot of, we can't be the oppressor because we have been oppressed, she reports. And thus, the Irish have blocked an insight into their own moral culpability by their own narrative of victimology. At the very least, we can say that the older kinds of self-knowledge are difficult to attain and require moral courage and a strong stomach. But can we acquire such a heart and such a stomach if we are steeped in a marinade of entitlement and resentment? Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.